Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 5th, 2018, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleform conference call. This afternoon, our conversation is on the recent decision in Collins v. Virginia, handed down by the Supreme Court this past week. My name is Micah Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Greg Brower, who is a shareholder at Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck. After hearing from our speaker, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us. Greg, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Micah, very much. It is my privilege to lead a discussion about this recent U.S. Supreme Court case, Collins versus Virginia. So let me give a brief overview of the case, and then we'll have some time for Q&A. Collins versus Virginia was a U.S. Supreme Court case argued on January 9th of this year and decided just last week on May 29th. It was an 8-1 decision with Justice Alito dissenting. Justice Thomas, while joining the majority opinion, also authored a concurring opinion, which was very interesting, and I'll get to that here in a minute. Justice Sotomayor wrote the majority opinion. The case presented the question of whether the automobile exception to the Fourth Amendment permits a police officer, without a warrant, to enter the curtilage of a house in order to search a vehicle. The court said no. A little bit about the background of this case. The facts underlying the case are pretty straightforward. A couple of police officers in Albemarle County, Virginia, had reason to believe that each of them had experienced a run-in with the same motorcyclist who had committed a traffic violation and then fled. Upon some investigation, they concluded that the subject motorcycle was likely stolen and in the possession of one Ryan Collins, the petitioner in this case. One of the officers then went to the house of Collins' girlfriend to investigate. There he observed what appeared to be the motorcycle in what might be called a carport adjacent to the house with a tarp covering it. He entered the property, including the carport, examined the motorcycle, ran a search of the motorcycle's license plate, and determined that the motorcycle was, in fact, stolen. He then returned to his patrol car to wait for Collins to appear at the house. Shortly thereafter, Collins did appear, and he entered the house. The officer then knocked on the door. Collins answered and agreed to talk. Collins admitted that the motorcycle was his, but said that he had purchased it without a title. Collins was then arrested and later indicted by a grand jury in Virginia for receipt of stolen property. Before trial, Collins filed a motion to suppress the fruits of the officer's search of the motorcycle, arguing that he had improperly trespassed onto the curtilage of the house in violation of the Fourth Amendment. That motion was denied by the trial court, and Collins was eventually convicted after a trial. The Virginia Court of Appeals affirmed the conviction, finding that exigent circumstances justified the warrantless search. The Virginia Supreme Court then also affirmed, but it took a different approach and relied upon the Fourth Amendment's automobile exception to affirm the decision. The U.S. Supreme Court then granted cert. The majority opinion, again written by Justice Sotomayor, was joined by seven others. And in that opinion, the court first acknowledged that the search of a vehicle can be reasonable without a warrant, essentially acknowledging and reaffirming the automobile exception that was first set forth in the Carroll versus United States case back in 1925. And then the court briefly explained its various holdings on that point of law over the years. The court's opinion next explained the curtilage concept that we all remember from law school. And then in kind of combining those two concepts, the court found as follows. It first of all found that the subject motorcycle was in fact in the curtilage of the house. As we all know, the definition of curtilage is subject to interpretation, and the court found that on the facts of this case, the motorcycle, which again was in a carport sort of area adjacent to the house, was in fact in the curtilage of the house. And secondly, the court found that the officer did invade the curtilage of the house in conducting the search. The question, though, then for the court was whether the auto exception, the automobile exception, trumped the curtilage invasion, therefore making the search reasonable. The court concluded that it did not. Now, Virginia had relied on a couple of arguments in seeking an affirmance of the lower court decision. First, it pointed out that the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Scher case, it's S-C-H-E-R, from 1938, in which federal agents stopped a bootlegger's car after it entered into a garage within the curtilage of the driver's residence, did not apply. The court found Scher to be inapposite because the agents in that case first encountered the subject vehicle when it was still driving on the street and simply followed it as it entered a garage. Moreover, in that case, the driver, upon exiting his vehicle in the garage, admitted to the agents that the vehicle did contain contraband. Virginia also relied upon the 1996 case, Pennsylvania versus LeBron, in which the U.S. Supreme Court held that a warrantless search of a truck parked in a driveway, upheld the warrantless search of a truck parked in a driveway. The Supreme Court was also not persuaded by this argument in that case, the court concluded, the LeBron case, the truck's owner did not have any Fourth Amendment interest in the subject driveway or in the house adjacent to the driveway. And moreover, the court said that in the LeBron case, it was not clear that the subject driveway was curtilage. Alternatively, Virginia argued in this case that the court should draw a bright line and simply hold that the auto exception applies unless the subject automobile is inside of a fixed enclosed structure. And again, the carport in question here was essentially an open air structure sort of half walls on two sides. It was adjacent to the house on the third side and then open to the driveway. So what Virginia said argued was, look, unless the automobile is inside of a garage structure or for some reason inside of a house, then the automobile exception to the warrant requirement should apply. Again, the majority rejected these arguments and ultimately reversed and remanded the case for the trial court to determine whether some other exception to the warrant requirement, like the exigent circumstances exception, might apply. Now, moving on to the Thomas concurrence before we talk about the dissent. Justice Thomas's concurrence was interesting in that it was a chance for him to talk about the exclusionary rule and his thoughts thereon. He said at the outset of his concurrence that he joined the majority opinion because, as he wrote, quote, it correctly resolves the Fourth Amendment question, end quote. But he wrote the separate opinion to express his view that the exclusionary rule cannot bind the states. He, in his concurring opinion, went through the history of the rule and reiterated his opinion that modern Supreme Court decisions make clear that the exclusionary rule is not required by the Constitution and therefore cannot be applied in the mandatory way to the states. And indeed, he suggested that the U.S. Supreme Court should revisit that rule and clarify it. But in his view, until and unless the court does clarify that point of law, he wasn't willing to go along with the majority's decision with respect to the suppression motion. So on to the dissent by Justice Alito. In a what I would call a very typically kind of tough-worded dissent, Justice Alito started with the following. He wrote, quote, "The Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches. What the police did in this case was entirely reasonable. The court's decision is not," end quote. Maybe a little bit of Justice Scalia in that opening line. He also, Justice Alito in his dissent, also made a reference to a famous line from Oliver Twist later on in his dissent. Basically, Justice Alito, and again, only Justice Alito, this was an 8-1 decision, thought that the auto exception applied in this case because the motorcycle was not in the house, and in fact, not even in an enclosed garage. And because it was a motor vehicle, the exception simply applied. He focused on whether the search was reasonable and concluded that it was. For him, in his dissent, a vehicle in a driveway, or as was the case here, in a carport, is no different than a vehicle parked on the street, which he opined everyone would agree would fall under the auto exception. And so just because the car was parked up, or the motorcycle in this case, was parked up a driveway and in this carport, he just, because it was a motor vehicle, didn't think it made a difference that it was in the curtilage, so to speak. He concluded by suggesting that the ultimate, and I'm quoting here, quote, "The ultimate inquiry under the Fourth Amendment is whether a search is reasonable. And that inquiry often turns on the degree of the invasion of privacy, or intrusion of privacy." So let me just read that again. His focus was on the following, and he said, quote, "The ultimate inquiry under the Fourth Amendment is whether a search is reasonable, and that inquiry often turns on the degree of the intrusion on privacy. In this case," end quote, "in this case, he simply decided that the intrusion was negligible, and as a result, the Fourth Amendment was not violated." So that's my take on the decision, the majority opinion, the concurring opinion, and the dissent. And I'd be happy to entertain any questions the audience may have. Micah?
Thank you, Greg, for those opening comments and that analysis. Let's move on to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. Again, to request the floor, enter star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your questions. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. While we're waiting for the questions to line up, Greg, what do you think is going to happen below when after this case is remanded?
Well, Micah, it's hard to tell, of course, but the fact that it was remanded with a clear suggestion by the court that should an exigent circumstance situation be found by the trial court, that the search could be deemed not in violation of the Fourth Amendment, suggests that's exactly what Virginia will argue. If I had to predict, I could see the court siding with Virginia in making that argument. But
all right, and we have a caller lined up, so let's move on to our first question.
Hi, I wanted to know, thank you for your comments, but can you talk a little bit more about the case that you mentioned that Virginia cited in terms of the truck being in a driveway? I kind of have a case with some similar facts, and I just wanted to know a little bit more about that.
I'm sorry, thank you for your question. You wanted to know more about which case exactly?
I don't have the name, but it was regarding where the Virginia relied on it in that a truck parked in a driveway was not the curtilage, and it was not, the Supreme Court was not persuaded by that case that they had cited.
Yeah, let me just pull that up here. Virginia had cited two other Supreme Court cases. One was the Scherer case. That had to do, in that case, the vehicle had been pursued by law enforcement into a garage. And so in that's a very old case, obviously, from 1938. The court had decided that because of the fact that the law enforcement had watched the vehicle pull into the garage and because the driver admitted that the vehicle contained contraband, that didn't apply. The second case, maybe the one you're referring to, Pennsylvania versus LeBron from 1996, U.S. Supreme Court case. In that case, the vehicle at issue was a pickup truck that was parked in a driveway, but there was no evidence in that case that the driver of the pickup truck had any association at all with the house that was adjacent to the driveway. And apparently the record in that case did not include a finding that the driveway itself was part of the curtilage of the house. And so the court found that case just not to not be helpful to its decision in this case. Thank you.
And while we're waiting for the next question to line up, Greg, as far as Justice Thomas's concurrence on whether or not the federal exclusionary rule should always be applied to the states, kind of approaching it from a federalism perspective, do you see the Supreme Court tackling that issue in a future case? And if so, how might the rest of the justices feel about that if it was a central issue?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And Justice Thomas clearly saw this case as an opportunity to reiterate his views on the exclusionary rule. I don't know of a case out there that might be in the pipeline that would bring this back before the court, but it is obviously a very interesting issue. For years, going back to the Mapp versus Ohio case, it was kind of conventional wisdom that the exclusionary rule was a constitutional mandate because the court in the Mapp case suggested that it was, but it was later decided by the court or clarified by the court in the, I guess it was the Davis case in 2011, that the exclusionary rule is not required by the Constitution. So it's sort of an open question as to, how that issue should be treated or applied going forward. And it sounds like Justice Thomas, for one, would like to take it up. I don't know if there's consensus on the court to do so. And, of course, it would take the right case coming to the court to readdress that. So we'll see.
Okay, I don't see any more questions lined up yet. Our next Teleform conference call will be scheduled for Thursday, June 7th at 2 p.m., and it will be on The Lies of the Constitution, 10 Exceptional Minds That Shaped America's Supreme Law, a new book by Joseph Tartakovsky. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleform conference calls on the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org. And we have another question lined up, so without further ado, we'll move on to the next question.
Hi. I haven't actually read the full opinion, other than just the syllabus and some quick reviews. I'm wondering, I just did a search, though, in the opinion, and the court doesn't talk at all about implied license, but I kind of, my understanding of Fourth Amendment trespass jurisprudence is that, you know, the first question is, are they on curtilage? But if they are, do they have an implied license to be there? They just sort of stopped with finding that because the carport was, you know, within the home's curtilage, thus there was a search?
Right. That's a great question. And in fact, the implied license issue was debated some during oral argument. But you're right, it wasn't really mentioned in the opinion itself in that way. But the parties stipulated that there was probable cause to be there. But obviously where they differed was whether or not a warrant was required.
I see. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
And I'll ask another question, Greg, while we see if there's any more questions left in the audience. As far as Alito's kind of being by himself on this case, was it surprising to you that he did end up completely on his own and he didn't get any other justices to join his reasoning?
Well, it's somewhat. You know, these criminal procedure issues can make for strange alliances on the court, as we all know, Justice Scalia was a stickler for Fourth Amendment issues, and Justice Thomas often followed him. I guess it surprised me a little bit that no one joined Justice Alito in this dissent, but he obviously felt, as indicated by the opening line, which I quoted, he felt that this was a pretty simple case and had no trouble deciding it in the way that he did, at least in terms of his dissent. I guess I'm always surprised when there's just one dissent. It's usually much more divided than that, as we all know. I was surprised.
Okay. And we have another question lined up, so we'll move on to that caller.
Hi, I'm wondering if you could talk a bit more about the exigent circumstances argument that was made and that might be made on remand.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. I think it's the usual, in this context, it's the usual exigent circumstance of the evidence in question being easily movable because it's a motor vehicle in this case. And so, the argument would basically be that because leaving the scene and taking the time to obtain a warrant would give the owner or possessor of the evidence an opportunity to move the evidence, thereby depriving it from law enforcement, is the exigent circumstance that would justify a warrantless search. Which is essentially, the underlying basis for the automobile exception. In this case, the majority just thought that the fact that in this case, the motor vehicle, the automobile, the motorcycle, was in the curtilage of a house, at least the automobile exception itself didn't apply. Whether some other argument can be made to the trial court that an exigent circumstance applies, I guess, remains to be seen. And there was a lot at oral argument. There was a lot of discussion about various hypotheticals, like what if You know, if a law enforcement officer sees through an open window a pile of cocaine inside of a house, does the fact that if he leaves to get a warrant, the occupant of the house would have an opportunity to flush the contraband down the toilet, create an exigent circumstance or not? A lot of back and forth on those sorts of hypotheticals. So it seems to me that given the fact that the majority teed up the argument in the opinion, that's likely what Virginia will argue on remand. And I don't know if there were any dissents in the Virginia Supreme Court, but the fact that it went through three levels in the Supreme Court in the Virginia system, with at each level the court siding with the state, I guess I would predict that the state has a pretty good shot if it reconfigures its argument of getting another crack at this. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. And not seeing any more questions lined up currently, I'll give Greg, if you would like a chance to have closing remarks.
Well, thank you very much, Micah. Only to say thank you for those who listened and had questions. Another interesting case in what has been an interesting term. I guess a few more to come. And I know I could speak for everyone at the Federal Society when I say that we appreciate the interest and the participation today. Thank you very much.
Yes, we are always very happy to have so many questions. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.